Daily event cancellations amidst the spread of COVID-19, please confirm KGNU's community calendar listings by visiting the event venue website for up-to-date information.
This is KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins.
In challenging times, KGNU is drawing on the ingenuity and expertise of our staff and volunteers to bring you programming that informs and soothes. In the spirit of flexibility in changing times, we are extending the opportunity for listeners to help KGNU sustain programming over the next couple of months. We know that we can do it with the support of the communities we serve. Please visit KGNU.org and make your contribution. Together, we can get there, and thank you.
This program is made possible by you, the KGNU listener members, and by Attention Homes, a local nonprofit providing safe housing and supportive services to youth facing homelessness in Boulder County. More information about Attention Home programs and how you can help mitigate homelessness at attentionhomes.org.
I have in the line Lauren Cobb. He is a mathematician who specializes in social processes. Lauren, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about what's happening with coronavirus or COVID-19. Lauren Cobb is an associate research professor in the Department of Mathematical and Statistical Sciences. He is an applied mathematician who specializes in dynamic spatial models of general social processes, including epidemics, public health emergencies, refugee problems, population flows, economic collapse, ethnic cleansing, and civil wars. Lauren has written numerous simulation models of societies in extreme distress. These models have been used since 1994 in international civil-military policy exercise in complex humanitarian emergencies, disaster relief operations, United Nations peacekeeping operations, and high-level national strategic planning. It is great to have you on the phone to explain to us the importance of understanding the models that we are being shown lately in television. It's not so easy for everybody to understand.
Unlike a lot of mathematicians, I'm in the field a lot. I've spent, I guess, a total of maybe 20 years in the field, focusing on helping national governments, especially the people in the second and third and fourth levels of government, the people who really do the work, trying to help them with their strategic planning and with emergency management.
How do you create a model for a pandemic like this one that we are facing right now?
It's a very good question, because a lot of people don't know what goes into a model. The word model is just too flexible. But in the area of epidemiology, epidemics generally, we have two major types of models. One is called agent-based, which simply means that it focuses on the behavior of individuals, and it's like a computer simulation of individual behavior. So a population might be represented by 10,000 little so-called agents. Some of them are children, some of them are grown-ups, and they move around, they have a home, they have a school, or they have a place of business, or they go to the market, they interact with each other. And the epidemic is transmitted from person to person, and then you look at the overall number of people who are infected, recovered over time in the model. And that tells you, if the model is right, it tells you what the epidemic is likely to look like. The other major type is population-based. So there are no individuals. We divide up the landscape into little cells, maybe 1 mile by a mile or 10 miles by 10 miles. And there's a population inside that cell, which works according to mathematical principles. There's a class of epidemic models. Divides a population into susceptible or infected or recovered. There can be up to 10, 20 categories of disease states at the ground level, the fundamental level of the model. What we're looking at is proportions, proportion of the population that is infected, proportion that is susceptible, proportion that's immune, those sort of things. The most important thing is that each cell in the model has its own internal dynamics and then interacts with neighboring cells. So people might visit or in some way interact across cells, across space, and that allows the transmission of the epidemic disease, and we can actually see it on a map spreading across the countryside. It's very dramatic. You get these movements of infection from a source, typically in a city, but not always, and it infects the city, and then it moves out into the surrounding territories, and then it hits another city. If you've got transportation in the model, then we can see long-distance transmission carried by airplanes, for example, or ocean ships. And these are lovely to watch. I mean, really, if you pick your colors right, you know, you have bright red for the infection and blue for recovered, for example. Get these colored maps that are just vibrating and moving. And if under a lot of circumstances, when you're doing epidemic modeling, it scares you. It really scares you. It's such a visual representation of what's happening to the population. So those are what we mean by models.
With this new virus like COVID-19, with limited data, how does it affect the accuracy of the models?
Data is typically collected by public health officials or government agencies for the purpose of making decisions. Epidemiologists need data for a different purpose. We need the same kind of data generally, but in order to figure out how the virus works. Is it airborne or waterborne or mosquito-borne, for example? Is it highly infectious or not very? Is there any immunity given by having the disease? And how long does it last? And how long does it take to become infectious? All of these things we know in the real world only through testing. So the data from the testing helps us set the critical factors in the model, and that determines its accuracy.
So what measures should the government have taken to avoid what's going on right now, from your point of view and your expertise in the field?
I think it's fair to say, from the point of view of every modeler from any discipline who has tried to create a model of the epidemic in order to look into the future, the government should have done enough testing and other kinds of measurements. I mean, just calling people, sampling them. How are you feeling today? Do you have a fever? This sort of information gathering is absolutely critical to know what is actually going on. It's a little bit, you can think of it, these things in part as like a political poll before an election. Every politician wants all the polling they can get. They need to know what are the questions that are bothering the voters. What are they not concerned with? What political parties do they depend on? Or are they independent of any party? Are they even going to vote? Every politician understands the importance of that kind of data. And in epidemics, it's exactly the same. We need to know that stuff. And studies, however they are done, whether it's by telephone or going out into the field, whether it's medical testing or it's just a simple observation of a temperature, body temperature, these pieces of information are going to be put together to almost decode how the virus works, what its dynamics are, so that we can make accurate models and predict the future with some degree of I don't want to say certainty, some degree of confidence.
Testing in itself does not stop the spread of COVID-19. Why is testing so important right now?
It's indirectly contributing to stopping the spread. For example, testing would have revealed the extent to which people are passing the disease before they show symptoms. So they have no awareness of being sick, and yet they're passing the illness. That is the most dangerous kind of epidemic, and that's exactly what we're facing here. And we don't even know to this day whether it's 1 day or 2 days or maybe 3 days worth of passing the epidemic, passing the disease from person to person before symptoms show up, kind of thing that will help stop the spread.
Can you explain in simple words that expression everybody is using in media? We hear it a lot. We need to flatten the curve. Flattening
right.
the curve. What's the meaning of that, really?
I heard that a politician has recently called it stepping on the sombrero. So the curve that we're trying to flatten is known as the epidemic curve, and it shows how many people are newly affected. So brand new infections per unit of time, let's say a week, and you graph it over time. So the horizontal axis from left to right is the passage of time, marked off, let's say, in weeks or days. And the vertical axis is usually it's the number of new cases. So epidemiologists actually have a name for that. They call it incidence. The number of new cases, or the rate at which new cases occur, is what goes up and down. It starts out before the epidemic very, very low, essentially at zero. And then a few new cases appear, and they infect some other people, and it begins to move through the population. And so the number of new cases is increasing, and it rises and accelerates as it goes. And then it begins to level off at some magical moment. Everybody would love to know when it's going to level off. And it decelerates further, and to the point where the number of new cases is really diminishing, and we're falling down the epidemic curve on the other side. It's like a hill. We climb the hill, and then we get to the top, and then we head down the other side. Flattening the curve means we don't want it to be as sharp. This coronavirus is a disease which infects very rapidly, and infects a lot of people if they don't take precautions. And so the acceleration is tremendous, and it just zooms almost straight up. In that type of disease, there's typically a sharp peak, and then it suddenly reverses direction and heads down, and you get this very high, very sharp peak. That's really dangerous, because that's going to completely devastate hospitals. And in order to avoid destroying our medical system, we need to bring the top of the curve down. That's called flattening the curve, which means lowering the rate of acceleration, which means slowing down the transmission from person to person. And that has the effect not only of reducing the acceleration, so the peak is much lower, but it's much flatter. It's a big, fat, smooth curve instead of a sharp peak. And it's shifted to the right, so we're actually delaying the peak of the epidemic.
This expression of delaying is what I understand much better from the model. It sounds redundant, but I want to ask you again, so how does social distancing contribute to flattening this curve, this peak that you have described?
I think a lot of people wonder about that. It's a common question. If we see each other less often, which is what we really mean by social distancing, we stand 6 feet away from each other, we try to limit the number of people we come in contact with, that reduces the rate of transmission from people who have the disease and don't know it to people who are susceptible to the disease, simply because social interactions have been reduced.
So with your work in the field and your experience, what do you see different this time?
I've never seen an epidemic before in my life that had such a high rate of transmission and such a long latency period between the time you actually are infected and the time you show symptoms. That's the time when you don't know you have the disease, but you're spreading it. The most dangerous time, and which kills in such an odd manner. Major epidemic that we all think about, the worldwide pandemic of so-called Spanish flu, which really began in Kansas, but it was attributed to Spain because Spain had an open press and they talked about it a lot. So we think it started in Spain in 1918 and took over the whole world, and that was killing people by hitting the hardest, the people with the strongest immune systems. So there, it would trigger a strong immune system in some robust 20-year-old kid. And that immune system would fight back, go too far. It would overreact. You would have a storm of immune reaction. And the battle would cause fluid to build up in the lungs. And these poor kids would literally drown from fluid in the lungs, which we call pneumonia, caused by this overreaction of the immune system. So it devastated people from the ages of 18 to 28 and older people without that kind of immune system. Suffered very little. They suffered, but it was much, much less. And that, we call it a cytokine storm. That kind of storm of the immune system is something we all think about. Well, it isn't here in this epidemic. It seems to be leaving infants and young people alone to a great extent, and then devastating people who are, well, we used to say over 70, and then it was over 60, and now we're thinking actually maybe it's over 30. So the older half of our population, at least, is being hit the hardest. And that's rather remarkable. And I think we still need to know a lot about the dynamics of this disease. Maybe it's hitting infants, but without symptoms. Maybe it's hitting the whole population the same, and it's only the elderly who are dying simply because they have so many other conditions on the side, like damaged lungs or compromised immune systems or a heart disease, whatever it is, and sometimes multiple problems, chronic illnesses, will cause you to be much more susceptible to any disease that comes along.
You put it in perspective by bringing the Spanish flu 1918. I didn't know that it started in Kansas.
I want you and everyone to understand that this is not and will not be an isolated, singular circumstance. This pandemic is one of a series that we have been experiencing, including Ebola coming out of Africa, SARS coming out of China, MERS, and a few others. And the reason there are so many right now is because our population in Africa is pressing up against animal populations and giving more opportunity for the virus or strange viruses that used to infect only animals to jump across and hit the human population and become human diseases. The ones in China have a similar origin. It just isn't jungle that we're dealing with, like bats in the jungle for our current coronavirus, but it's diseases, for example, of chickens, birds, other animals that are in very close proximity to people. In Southeast Asia, people have chickens right in the home, and some kids fall in love with their pet chickens and they sleep with them, and they can get an avian bird-based virus pretty quickly, and that was the origin of SARS. So this is going to happen on a regular basis, where it's just every 5 or 10 years we're going to have another major pandemic spreading around the world from a virus that recently made the hop from animals to people. We need to recognize that our high population density and growing prosperity have pushed more and more people into contact with animals. And we have this enormous disparity of income, which means that the poorest people are truly desperate about food. And they're the ones who are buying jungle meat, bush meat, they call it. It's dead wild animals who have been brought in on God knows what circumstances and hygienic standards out of the jungle and slaughtered by some amateur and sold in a dirty market somewhere in Congo or even a meat market in the middle of China. So these are things we can do something about. China needs to improve its public health regulation to extend to even the tiniest meat market out there. And Southeast Asia, which is rapidly growing, developing economically, needs to move pets into cages. Isolate them. Don't sleep with them. It may be nice and warm to have a big mammal next to you, like a dog. A lot of Americans sleep with dogs, but it's not a good idea. And if you're going to do that, make very sure that that dog or animal has had its immunizations so they don't pass a disease over to you. So public health is the name of the game here, and it's simply mobilizing our huge resources to do a little bit of regulation of how people interact with food sources and with animals. Whenever we did exercises in pandemic response, the first inclination of the police and the military is to send people who are ill straight to hospital or to set up huge quarantine zones. The problem with that is you have to actually protect your hospitals from too many people arriving. The danger is too many people, and they overwhelm the medical systems. All the doctors get sick, all the nurses get sick, they can't do their jobs anymore, and the hospital simply becomes this awful pit of disease and infection, which spreads the infection outwards into the society. You've done the worst thing you could possibly do. So that's why so many epidemic response lessons begin with tell people to stay at home and give them the instruction they need to cope with the disease in their homes. That's the core instruction in epidemic response.
We had the opportunity today to talk to Lauren Kopp. He is an associate research professor in the Department of Mathematical and Statistics Sciences at the University of Colorado, Denver. He is now retired, and he has been speaking with us, explaining to us what these models, these mathematical models are all about in a way that we can understand. Thank you so much, Lauren, for your time today.
It was my pleasure. You can call anytime.
For KGNU, I am Rosanna Longo.
WelcomeTo.org, KGNU's look at local nonprofits.
Many nonprofits in the community are working extra hard to help the most vulnerable in the community during the COVID-19 pandemic. Jewish Family Service in Boulder is having a food drive for Passover. Mary Pierce is Volunteer Services Coordinator.
50 bags is our goal, so unfortunately, we did a big like a donation drive at the JCC, which the building has been closed, so they let us use their parking lot for it. And it was the morning of last Thursday that Jared Polis kind of locked down the state of Colorado, and we all got those messages on our phones with the alerts, and that ticket made a lot of people nervous and kind of freaked them out. And that was the morning of my drive, so we didn't get the kind of response that we had hoped. I think people were like, nah, you know, as we all are kind of growing with this pandemic and trying to figure out what we're supposed to do and not do. So we didn't get the amount of people coming to the food donation drive as we thought. So now, working with the JCC, they are closed, but they have a staff person that works there every day that's a security person, and he's taking in any donations that are dropped off for us. So so folks can go drop off a donation anytime at the JCC at the front door, and he takes it in from 9 to 5 Monday through Friday. So they can just leave it right there, and he's taking it in. And then next week we're going to put it all together and deliver them.
Outside of this particular grocery drive that's really in honor of Passover, are there other ways for the community to support the work that you're doing? And just give us a sense of, you know, how you have to step up even more as a nonprofit during these times.
Yeah, for sure. We are also doing, we have a big drive to help with emergency assistance programs in Boulder and our Denver office, but we're trying to, we have a big drive, a financial drive going on right now that's getting matched by $100,000 for anybody wanting to donate. And those are funds that go directly to people for their rent and emergency assistance, definitely with a lot of struggling elders in their home to pay their mortgage, to pay their rent, to pay their utilities. So it's a big fund that we're part of, supporting people with emergency assistance. So we're involved with that. And folks can apply for that too. Folks in Boulder, they can just get a hold of us at the Boulder Jewish Family Services. So we're doing this definitely an emergency financial assistance program. It goes for phone bills also and other necessities, essential services. We have care management, so we have a mental health hotline, so people can call that and just talk to someone. And that's been kind of going on 24/7, so that's something where we're providing people can reach out just on the phone and talk to someone. We have a care manager in Boulder that's working with people directly to help with kind of just emotional and or other special needs that they have during this time.
Well, Mary, your title is Volunteer Services Coordinator. I know many nonprofits are also struggling with volunteer hours as well because of the stay-at-home order and people isolating themselves and different things. Is that an issue that you're dealing with as well?
It is an issue we're dealing with, but it's one of those kind of particular situations, because as much as we have people that want to volunteer and we need volunteers, we have to be very limited to the amount of people. So even when we're putting together these bags, we have a limited time that we can be into the JCC. We have to obviously be 6+ feet apart from each other and wear gloves and that type of thing. So even though I do always need volunteers, yeah, I think after this pandemic, I'll probably need volunteers even more so. Right now, it's kind of limited because of the limited isolation situation that we're in right now. So the answer is yes, we always need volunteers. And I would love for anybody to contact me concerning volunteering. When it comes to this Passover drive, we really just need the food items in now, because the use of volunteers is just so limited with the rules that we're dealing with.
Find out more at jewishfamilyservice.org.
For their link and another listen, go to our blog at kgnu.org/dotorg.
We at KGNU are dedicated to bringing you coverage of breaking news as it happens. You're hearing from experts and scientists telling you what to worry about and not worry about. The reliable information you find here is made possible by donations from listeners like you. The most important thing you can do to support this work is to become a member today by going to kgnu.org. And thank you.
This program is supported by you, the KGNU listener member, and by Save Home Heat Company, providing professional service and installation of heating, cooling, plumbing, and electrical systems, proudly serving the Boulder, Denver area for over 35 years. More information at savehomeheat.com.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Dr. Larry Brilliant. Outbreaks are inevitable. Pandemics are optional. In the spring of 2017, at a release party for his book, Sometimes Brilliant, he sketched out the extraordinary voyage from civil rights movement to med school, to helping out as physician during the occupation of Alcatraz by the Indians of all tribes. In the Bay Area, Larry Brilliant connected with the psychedelic and music counterculture. He followed the hippie trail from London over the Khyber Pass to India with his wife Elaine, Wavy Gravy, and the Hog Farm Commune. Neem Karoli Baba, one of India's best-known spiritual teachers, told him his destiny was to work for the World Health Organization to help eradicate smallpox. Larry Brilliant became a key participant in eliminating that 10,000-year-old disease that killed 500 million people in the 20th century alone. Smallpox was declared eradicated in 1980. This is a 3-minute clip recorded in March 2017. Larry Brilliant is predicting the deadly mistakes that were made from January 2020 on when the corona pandemic began.
There's sort of a mixed story about pandemics. You know Ebola and Zika, MERS and SARS, Lassa fever, swine flu, bird flu. There's been more animal viruses jumping from animals to humans in the last 30 years than we have records of before. And that's worrisome. But much more worrisome than that is that the institutions that normally keep us safe are sort of AWOL. In the Ebola outbreak, Obama sent 3,500 American soldiers to West Africa. We spent billions of dollars because WHO failed in its job to protect us, because it took 6 months to correctly identify what the disease was that was killing people in West Africa. So WHO is going to have a new director general in May, and I think it's going to go through a period of self-examination, and it's offline. And I think this presidency, as far as pandemics, is offline. You're not going to see public health, let alone pandemic preparedness, at the top of the priority list for this White House. And they fired the head of CDC, and Trump is cutting the budget for public health and pandemic preparedness. So if you look at those agencies that normally keep us safe, the federal government, WHO, the UN, CDC, they're all offline. We have to have a safety net to protect us, to stop pandemics, to end the threat of pandemics. April 7th is World Health Day. It is also the 100th anniversary of the great influenza, the Spanish influenza, the 1917 to 1918 pandemic. One of my grandparents died in that. One of Girich's grandparents died in that. I wonder how many other people know that in your genealogy, some of your relatives died from that, because somewhere between 25 million and 100 million people died in that 1 year period. And if you put that to today's numbers, you're talking about 75 to 300 million.